Let's go. Where are we? We're supposed to be in Yehoshua. I have no idea where we are. But we're supposed to be in Yehoshua. Today we're going to be in Dvarim.
Oh, we're going to be in Dvarim?
Today we're going to be in Dvarim.
The whole time?
Yeah, mostly.
Is there a handout today?
Yes, there is. There's lots today. Well, you have a lot to cover. Okay.
And I won't switch for paper to do this.
Yeah.
Right. Just
okay, we'll give you the handout early, okay? Does that make life easier for you?
Yes. Students. Thank you.
All right. We promised one more discussion on the topic of the morality of Sefer Yehoshua. We've dealt with the question of our right to the land, the religious or theological connection between our loyalty to God and the land. We dealt with the issue of the conquest of the land from a political standpoint, Abraham's initial conquest of Canaan from the conquering empires of Kedorlaomer. We've addressed the issue from a number of different vantage points. We have danced around and avoided what is the real issue. What is the real issue? The real issue is not whether or not we had the right to conquer Canaan. In the ancient world, there was no question of political right to a land, where the stronger nation got the land. That's the way it worked. And nobody raised, there was no United Nations, and there was no Geneva Convention. It's just the way it happened, right? If you were to apply the Geneva Convention to today's world, America belongs to the Indians, and you know, we can all go home back to Europe and wherever we came from. Right? So, in the ancient world, the issue of the right of conquest was not so much the question that needed to be addressed, as much as the methodology, the way in which a land was conquered. And that brings us back to the psukim that we read and we looked at briefly once before. We're going to read them again. And this is really the focal point of the moral question of Sefer Yehoshua. So let's go back to Dvarim chapter 20, starting with verse 10. Ki tikrav el ir lihilachem aleha v'karata eleha l'shalom. When you approach a city to wage war against her, you must first offer a hand of peace. V'haya, im shalom ta'ancha, if they answer you with peace, so fine. So vayakol ha'am nimtza bayulach halamas v'avaducha. If they accept your peace, meaning they accept your terms, they essentially accept your sovereignty, then they will pay you tribute. They will pay you their taxes, and they will serve you. You will be the sovereign nation, and they will be your citizens. And if they won't wait, make peace with you, then they'll wage war with you, besiege the city, then if God will give them over into your hands, all of the males, which is another way of describing what we would call in today's vernacular combatants, those who hold the gun, right? So all the males, they can be killed by the sword. Rak hanashim v'hataf v'habehema v'chol ha'shiyah ba'ir kol shlala tavozlach. Women, children, animal, anything in the city, the non-combatants, the properties in the city, all of that is fair game for spoils of war. Miachaltat shlal oivecha shenatan Hashem alakech alach, and you shall consume the spoils of your enemies. So shall be the conduct with all of the cities that are very far away from you, meaning not from this land. Sorry, I skipped a line. Which are not from these nations, not from the indigenous population of the land of Canaan. But as far as the nations, the indigenous population of this land here that God has given you as an inheritance, lo techaye kol neshama. You may not leave any soul alive. Ki hacharem tacharimem, you shall utterly destroy them. Hachiti v'ha'amori v'ha'knizi v'ha'prizi hachivi v'ha'ibusi kasher tzivcha Hashem Elokecha, all the nations of Kna'an, and they are listed there, at least six out of the seven. Why is this so? Why is this so important? There's a reason for it. It's not an arbitrary declaration. Leman asher lo yilamdu etchem lasot k'chol to'avotam asher asu l'Elohim. So that they not influence you and teach you to do all of the abominations which they do to their gods, v'chatatem l'Hashem Elokechem, and cause you to sin to Hashem your God. Remember, idolatry is always linked to immorality. You have to always remember in the context of God, of the Torah's war against idolatry, that idolatry, pagan idolatry, at least the way it was practiced in the ancient world, was inherently immoral. It was always connected to child sacrifice and virgin rape and other such abominations. And the Torah's war against idolatry is always called to'avot, this abomination. You can ask anything you like. I may not answer, but you can ask.
No, because we're saying, you know, like in this having the United Nations, so it's a stronger nation, the sensitivities there will be different of, you know, conquering. And
that doesn't, in my mind, justify Lo Techayei Kol Neshama, but I accept the premise.
No, so then the same with, you know, we're looking at idolatry through our, you know, 21st century eyes.
No, we're looking at idolatry through the eyes of the Torah. The Torah prohibits murder. The Torah prohibits virgin rape. The Torah prohibits idolatry, calls them an abomination, explicitly points out, or points to Baal and Molech as the two Canaanite pagan rites that were prohibited. In other words, that's not a modern sensitivity. That's a Torah sensitivity. It comes directly out of the bulk of this text. And that war, that culture war is clear. How many times the Torah warned us against the idolatries of Canaan as a to'eva, as an abomination. And you really can't understand that war unless you recognize the immorality of it and how much emphasis the Torah places overall on morality and ben adam l'chaveru. In other words, the notion of idolatry as being a function of God's zealousness, God doesn't like it when we worship other gods, by and of itself doesn't do it for me. It doesn't justify or it doesn't explain the depth of the Torah's animosity towards these cultures. Look, in the hierarchy of Torah, Shabbos is just as significant as idolatry. You don't find the Torah's animosity and hatred towards those who don't keep Shabbos. Right? You don't find the description of those who don't keep Shabbos as a toiva, even though in the theological sense it's equivalent to idolatry. So, but there's no overtone of abomination and disgust and destroy every temple and destroy every altar. Right? You don't have any of that. Because it's a purely theological issue of ben adam l'makom. So you either do it or you don't do it. Whereas when it comes to the idolatry of Canaan, it was so interconnected to the immorality of the society, the Sdom v'Amora ideology, that it's a war that the Ribbono Shel Olam wages with it. And we are the foot soldiers of that war. You can't separate the two. Of all the nation, of all of the examples of God intervening, changing nature to, and intervening in the world in order to destroy evil, are all examples of society that have degenerated morally. Dor HaMabul, Sdom v'Amora, Mitzrayim, they're all moral deprivation, not theological ones. It's the famous Rashi on in Breshit, why God doesn't destroy Dor HaPalaga, but he destroys Dor HaMabul. Right? The Tower of Babel, he tolerates, he just kind of intervenes in order to stop it, but he doesn't destroy it, nobody gets hurt. Whereas Dor HaMabul, he destroys all of humankind. So Rashi says, because Dor HaMabul was a Chet Ben Adam L'Chavero, to man and man, whereas the Tower was a, whatever the issue was between man and God. If the issue is purely a matter of between man and God, The Torah would have said it's us, so like Shabbos, finish. We would have moved on, right? But you wouldn't have waged a war over it. The war with Amei Canaan was because the cultures of Amei Canaan were not just foreign, they were immoral. And the nations that are far away, so they're also immoral. But the nations that are far away are not going to be an influence to you. Right? You want to put an ambassador into Mesopotamia and have an army and control of Mesopotamia because you've conquered the territory, isn't it? But that's not a Meknan. A Meknan are in your backyard. They're in your kishkas. They're sitting in your they're your neighborhood. And there, the Torah says, at least on the face of it, nobody survives. Nobody remains. Again, the question of innocence, combatants versus non-combatants, the question we will address, the moral question contained in these verses, but I think the overall tone of them are, of these verses, is the war with Canaan is not just a war against nations for territory and political control, it's a war against the culture of idolatry, pagan, immoral idolatry, that was the prevalent culture at the time. I'll show you another example of a similar notion where the conquest of Canaan is linked to this notion of idolatry. You take a look, for example, in Shemot, chapter 20, it's the end of Parashat Mishpatim, chapter 23. Hinei anochi sholeach malach lefanecha. Verse 20. Sorry, I forgot to tell you. Verse 20. Hold your finger on the place in Dvarim. I'm going to come back to Dvarim. Dvarim is the key verses for text for today. But I just want to show you these verses. Hinei anochi sholeach malach lefanecha. Lishmarcha baderech, I will send an angel, or send a messenger, some kind of malach before you to guard you as you go into the land of Israel. Lahaviyacha l'makom asher achinoti, so that you will come into the land that I have prepared for you. Hishamer mipanav, guard yourself from him. Protect yourself. How do you guard yourself? Meaning, ushma b'kolo al tamer bo. Hear his voice. Don't rebel against him. Whether this malach is a malach in an angelic sense of the term or a malach in the prophetic sense of the term. A malach could be a navi. So it's not clear, but either way, lo yisal lefishechem kishmi b'kubo, it's a reflection of the divine presence that accompanies us into the land of Israel, and we have to be loyal to God and be careful of sinning in God's presence. Gim shema tishma b'kulo v'sita kol asher adaber, va'ayavti et oivecha v'tzarti et tzararecha. If you will be loyal to God and to listen to his voice, then God will make your enemies his enemies and will make your challengers his challengers. Which is another way of saying God will fight our battles. Ki elech malachi lefanecha, my angel will go with you. V'viecha le'amori v'achiti v'haprizi v'aknani v'achivi v'haivusi, I will come into these nations, v'ichadati, I'll destroy them. Lo tishtachave l'Elohim v'lo ta'avdem. You shall not bow down to the idols, you shall not serve their gods, v'lo ta'aseh k'maseihem, or do according to their deeds. Ki hares taharsem v'shaber t'shaber matzevotahem. You shall utterly destroy them, break their monuments. V'vadetem et Hashem Elokechem, u'verach et lachmecha v'et memecha v'asivotim machalam mikibecha. And you shall serve God and only God in this context. Go down a couple of verses. Go down to verse 28. Eshalachti etatzira lefanecha v'gersha etachivi v'etaknani v'etachivti milefanecha. I will send some kind of an animal, a hornet as it's usually described, before you. I have ways of getting rid of these nations. You don't even have to fight your battle. I'll send the plague of some kind ahead of you, and it will get everybody running. You'll walk into the land, it'll be ready for you, you won't even have to fight. However, lo agarashenu mipanecha bashana achat, however, you should know that this is not going to happen immediately. I'm not going to get rid of all the people automatically and leave the land uninhabited until you're ready to go. Lest the land remain desolate, and then if you take an entire territory of land and there's no inhabited population there, what normally happens is uninhabited territory usually gets overwhelmed by wild animals, especially in a region that has a great number of forests and even jungles. The mystery of the jungle of Eretz Canaan, I will show you as we get to a little bit further into Sefer Yehoshua. It's one of the great jungle. You know that Eretz Canaan was a jungle? In many ways, it still is, but it's a jungle, absolutely. Lions and tigers and bears. Oh my! Ma'at ma'at agar shenu mipanecha. I will expel them slowly. My horn, whatever natural means I have for removing the indigenous population, that's God's department. You don't even have to fight them, says God. If you're loyal to God, you don't even have to fight them. But it'll happen slowly until you are multiplied enough that you can take over the land. Famous borders of the land of Israel, Euphrates to the Nile. I will give you the land, I will expel them from it. Now, that comes with a price tag. What's the price tag? Lo tichrot lahem v'lo lahem brit. The price tag is you can make no alliances with them or with their gods. Lo yeshvu b'artzecha. They can't stay in your land. Why not? Lest they lead you to sin against me, because they will be for you a stumbling block. They will lead you to serve their gods and their idolatries, and then we're back to square one. So I'll be happy to get rid of them for you on one condition. No alliances, no Brit, no peace treaties. They remove the idolatrous nations from your midst, and life goes on. This reiterated principle of a complete and total battle against the nations of Canaan appears in the Torah. We saw it in Sefer Shemot, clearly in Sefer Devarim, a couple of other individual or passing references in Chumash, but these are the two primary sources. So what does it sound like? It sounds like the Torah is essentially saying when you walk into the land of Canaan, as far as Mesopotamia is concerned, Egypt's nations beyond the boundaries of the borders of the land of Israel, they want to make treaties and alliances and kuzentayt. But when it comes to the nations of Canaan, the box, as we called it originally, this is a war to the end. Nobody can be left. Agreed? That's what it says? Like it or not, that's what it says, right? Okay. This is where life gets interesting. Because that's not what the halacha says. That seems to be what the text says, but it is not at all what the halacha says. And we have an enormous discrepancy between the understanding of this passage in the Gemara and in the halacha and the superficial reading of this passage as we have just done. And for that, we need to look at the source page that I have distributed. Everybody have a copy? Where are the extras? The extras are...
Are you saying there's a discrepancy
between the pshat as we just read it and the halacha?
As we read it, the dvarim...
Both. Correct. Correct. Both. We will have to reread it after we're finished and understand why.
Well, we can't take the pshat?
Well, you can, but then you'd have a direct, blaring contradiction between the halacha and the pshat, which happens from time to time, but in this particular instance, I think that that's not the case. I think that it's simply a question of how to read the pshat. We'll come back to it. Says the Gemara, Yerushalmi, Masechet Shvi'it. It appears in a number of sources. It appears in Yerushalmi. It appears in a couple of Midrashei Chazal, in the Medrash, and a version of it in the Bavli, and we'll see in the Rambam. Amar Rabbi Shmuel by Nachman, Shalosh Parstigiot. Anybody know what a parstigia is? Okay. Parstigia is a Greek word for a royal proclamation. Actually, the word proclamation actually has a certain sound similarity. Royal proclamation. Three letters. Shilach Yehoshua le'eretz Yisrael ad shelo yikansu le'aretz. Before Yehoshua stepped foot into the land of Israel, says the Gemara, he sent ahead of himself, he sent three letters. In today's modern context, we do the same thing. We do it by dropping leaflets from the sky. But essentially, we do the same thing. We fly overhead, drop leaflets, and let whoever it is that we're about to bomb know that A, that we're about to bomb them, and B, what they can do to avoid the onslaught. What do these three letters say? It's essentially one letter with three options, is what the Gemara is describing. Mishuhu otzel lahafnot ifne. Anybody wants to leave now, you're welcome to do so. The door is open, north, south, you're welcome to go. Lehashlim yashlim. Anybody wants to make peace, we're open to that too. Here's our address. If you want a peace treaty, line up at the door. Lasot mechama, yasu mechama. You want to make war, so we're here, come and get us. Those are your three options. You can leave, you can make peace, or you can try to push us out by force. But we are going to be your next door neighbors by tomorrow afternoon. Girgashi Pina. Girgashi, one of the seven nations of Canaan mentioned only once in Chumash, Girgashi ran. We have no textual source for the fact that they ran, except for the fact that only once is Girgashi mentioned amongst the seven nations of Canaan. Every other time the Torah mentions the seven nations, it leaves out Girgashi. Chazal say it's because they ran, so they didn't need to be mentioned all the time. Girgashi Pina. Givonim Hishlimu. The Givonim made a peace treaty with us. We'll see that story in Yehoshua. Shloshim v'chad melech asu mechama. And 31 kings said, no, we're going to fight. And they did. And that's the 31 kings that Yeshua conquered, listed in chapter 12 of Sefer Yehoshua. How many kings in total were there in the land of Israel?
33?
No. That's the mystery. That's the optical illusion. 31 waged war. We assume there were 31 kings in the land of Israel. There weren't. Remember that each city has its own king. We're talking about little city-states. Every city has its own king. These 31 kings are the 31 kings of 31 different cities. But put it this way. In the area of Hevel Argov, Hevel Argov is the strip of land just beneath the Golan Heights, which was the territorial region of Og, Melech HaBashan, which Moshe conquers in Parshat Chukat. Torah in Sefer Dvarim says that in that region there were 60 cities. 60 cities in the area of the strip of land just beneath the Golan Heights called Hevel Argov. So if that's 60 cities in one little strip of land, how many cities were there in the land of Israel from north to south?
Hundreds.
31 of them decided to wage war with us. What happened to the rest of them? We don't know. We do know. They would just continue to live there, the Canaanites, and there were sections of the Canaanite land that we never got to, never conquered, never touched. But nonetheless, it's an optical illusion to think that we conquered every king or society in the land of Canaan. Be that as it may, what's fascinating about this passage in the Yerushalmi? Why did I say that that the halacha seems to contradict the text?
Because they had a choice to make peace.
Leave is easy, right? Leave is never an issue. They want to leave, and listen to hate. But the notion that the Gemara entertains the possibility that they had the right to make peace with us. They had the right to turn around and say, what are your terms? Let's make a peace treaty. You leave us alone, we'll leave you alone, we'll make a peace treaty. Legitimate? We're talking about Ameknan. We're not talking about nations far away. We're talking about the local indigenous population. I read the passage in Devarim with you. Remember it said, when you go to war against a city, you shall offer a hand of peace. If they make peace, good. If not, then you can kill all the males, but you can't touch the females. That's what you do to nations far away. Whereas the local population, lot chayeh kol neshama, you may not leave a soul alive. So where's the option to make peace? Maybe option to make peace?
To give up the God.
Convert to what? Convert to what? Become Jewish?
Yes.
So listen, but you understand that the text makes no allusion to that? The text says, Karat aleh l'shalom, nations are far away. Local population, lot chayeh kol neshama. However you want to split the hair, that seems to be the way to read the text. And yet the Gemara says Yoshua had the right to make peace with them. Not only that, says the Rambam, I'll go one step further. Rambam, Hilchot Melachim Perikei Alach Aleph. Ein ha-melach nilcham tchila ela melchemet mitzvah. You all know the difference between a melchemet mitzvah and a melchemet reshut? Fundamental difference in halacha. Two types of war. What essentially we are describing here in this passage of Devarim, two types of war, the Gemara calls a distinction between a Mechemet Mitzvah and a Mechemet Reshut. Mechemet Mitzvah is an obligatory war. Mechemet Reshut is an optional war. What's a Mechemet Mitzvah? What's an option? Let's start with Mechemet Mitzvah. What's an obligatory war?
Commanded by God.
So the Rambam writes, Ezu Mechemet Mitzvah, Zu Mechemet Shiva Amamim Mechemet Amalek. There are three paradigms of an obligatory war. One is a war against the seven nations of Canaan, which we are commanded to destroy. Another is the war against Amalek. And the third is Ezrat Yisrael Miyad Tzar Shaba Alehem, a war of self-defense. Fundamentally important because that's the operative principle of the IDF today, halachically. Ve'achakach nilcham b'mechemet ha-reshut. Then once a king has finished all of the obligatory wars, he has the right to engage in an optional campaign. What's an optional campaign? He mechamash shenilcham im shar ha'amim k'dei l'harchiv b'gvu Yisrael. The optional campaign is a campaign that the king wages outside of the borders of the land of Israel to expand the boundaries, the territorial boundaries of the land of the kingdom of Israel, much as David fought the battles in Syria and Mesopotamia to expand the boundaries of the land of Israel outside the normal box of Eretz Canaan. Provided that you finished all of the obligatory wars in your backyard, you can set your sights beyond the territorial boundaries. Mechemet Mitzvah versus Mechemet Reshut. So the Torah in Devarim sets out a formula for war that starts v'karat aleh l'shalom. You will seek peace first. And if they answer peace, then gesundheit. On that pasuk, Rashi writes, anybody here have a chumash with Rashi? No? Rashi writes four words. V'mechemet Reshut ha-katuv medaber. When the Pasuk says you will seek peace first, says Rashi, we're talking about a Mechemet Reshut. In the context of an optional war outside of the boundaries of the land of Israel, you want to seek peace, seek peace. Whereas when it comes to the Amei Canaan, Mechemet Mitzvah, you have an option to make peace? No, you have a mitzvah of Mechemet Mitzvah, to wage war. So understood Rashi in the Pasuk. That's not, however, how the Rambam understood it. Because the Rambam understood the Gemara that we just saw in the Yerushalmi differently. Says the Rambam in source number 3, which is Hilchot Melachim, Perek Vav. Ein osin milchama im adam ba'olam ad shekorim lo shalom. There is no war that you can wage with anybody in the world before you first extend an option of peace. Now listen to the next line carefully. echad mechemet harishut ve'echad mechemet mitzvah. That is whether we're talking about an optional war or an obligatory war. The option of peace is always first. Shene'emar, as it says, ki tikrav alir lilachem alav v'krat alel l'shalom, if you want to approach a city with war, first you have to extend peace. Im ishlimu v'kiblu sheva mitzvot shemitztavu b'nei noach alehen, ein horgin mehen neshama. If they make peace, and make peace means, even in the land of Israel, is contingent upon a condition. The condition is, right? What are the state your terms? What is the terms? The terms are very simple. You can maintain your own society and your own culture and your own independence and your own autonomy. You can do what you like. Leave us alone. One condition. The idolatry has to stop. The pagan the land of Canaan must become an idolatry-free zone. That's the Torah stipulation. Sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach, acceptance of the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach means that they do not have to convert to Judaism. They have to agree to certain fundamentals of theology and ethics. They can't kill each other anymore. They can't kill their children anymore. They can't rape their virgins anymore. All of that is inherently connected to the pagan idolatrous world. Sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach were designed to say no. It's a basic set of laws of ethics and conduct. Society of law, mishpat, din, judgment, courts, ethics. That's what the Sheva mitzvot were. The nations of Canaan were prepared to accept Sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach. They could live in peace and harmony, and we would not touch them. Now, who did that apply to? Any exceptions? Any exceptions? Amalek, right? We assume that the exception would be Amalek, right? Let's read on. Ve'im lo ishlimu, o sheishlimu v'lo kiblu sheva mitzvot. But what if they didn't make peace? Or they didn't accept the sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach? Then you make war with. Then there's war. Osini mehem milchama. And now the Rambam splits. Option one: Horgin kol hazacharim hagdolim ubozuzim kol mamonam v'tapam ve'en horgin isha v'lo katan. Option one is you kill the male combatants. You don't touch the women and children. You can take the spoils of war. That's option one. Skip to the third line of Halacha Dalid. B'med dvarim amurim b'mochemet harashut shu'im shar ha'umot. That's with regards to a mochemet harashut, optional other nations outside of the land of Israel, male combatants only, the rest of them are spoils of war. Aval, listen very carefully. Shiva amamim v'amalek. Shelo hishlimu. With regards to the seven nations or Amalek that did not make peace with us, then en menechim mehem neshama, then nobody can be left alive. We saw the psukim otachaya kol neshama. Uminayin, back to where it skipped to, and then he quotes the pasuk of Amalek, timched zecher Amalek, where it's in bold. Uminayin she'eno medaber ela be'elu shelo yishlimu. How do I know that this verse, even about Amalek, applies only to those who did not make peace? Shnehemar lo hayta ir asher hishlima b'nei Yisrael bilti achivi yoshvei givon et hakol lakhu b'mochama ki mi'et Hashem hayta lechazek et libam likrat b'mochama et Yisrael l'man hachlimam. Pasuk in Yoshua says that of all the nations of Canaan, the only one that offered, that extended peace, or that accepted the offer of peace, were the givonim. All the other nations did not, but that was by God's design. God hardened their hearts in order that we should have the opportunity to conquer their land. Michlau, sheshachu lahem l'shalom b'lo kiblu. If the Torah tells me, if the Navi tells me that the only one who accepted peace was the Givonim because God hardened their hearts, it means that at least at the level of international conduct, we offer the option of peace to all of them, including Amalek. So ends the myth that there's a perpetual battle against Amalek that must be waged in every generation, and regardless, you see an Amalek, you shoot them on the street. It's a myth. Amalek is a nation to be dealt with like all the other nations of Canaan. Only difference between Amalek and the nations of Canaan is that it's not one of the seven indigenous populations. Amalek was nomadic. So when you talk about the war against the seven nations of Canaan, it doesn't include Amalek. So Amalek needs a separate halachic definition, therefore a separate command. Zachorat asher salach Amalek. But the options remain the same, whether you're dealing with Amalek or you're dealing with the seven nations of Canaan. The option of peace is always there. There's a Ramban on the bottom of the page, which I'm not going to read through, but the Ramban on Chumash, the Ramban on the Pasuk of V'karat Alel Shalom, takes issue with Rashi. Rashi is the one who says that that Pasuk that says you will extend peace refers only to a Mechamet Rashut, whereas a Mechamet Mitzvah, there's no option of peace. The Ramban says that can't be the Pshat. After all, we saw in the Gemara, we saw in the Halacha, that the option of peace is always there, regardless of who we were fighting. Let me come back to this issue. It's a very important issue, and I want to address it, hopefully, still today. I like these phones that get you dancing. What happened to old-fashioned phones that just rang? Just rang. Yeah, I know. But I want to, before we look at how to deal with the question of the offer of peace, I first want to address the question of what did we do, Taka, when we ran into a nation that didn't make peace? How did we conduct this war? Did we implement the seemingly harsh terms of Lo Techaye Kol Neshama? So, I'll give you one example. Take a look in Yehoshua. Wow. That's different. Was that a... that's a vessel. That's good. Don't do that on my account. All right, Yeshua. Take a look at Yeshua chapter 10. I'll show you an interesting example. One example. We don't really need more than one example. There are many of them, but let's assume. What happened, Taka, when they walked into the land of Canaan? After all of this discussion about annihilation and obliteration and genocide and ethnic cleansing, all the modern terms that are so harsh. What did they do? They walked into the nation, into the land of Canaan, assuming for the moment they didn't make peace. We'll talk about the fact that they had the option of peace. But let's assume for the moment that they didn't make peace. So now they start the war. One nation after another, 31 kings. So let's give you, I'll show you one example of a battle. Chapter 10, verse 33. As Allah Horam Melech Gezer, Hazorat Lachish, Horam, king of Gezer. Gezer is a city. Anybody know where it is?
Excuse me? Where they play baseball today.
They play baseball in Gezer. It's right near Shalavim. Anyway, in those days it was a Canaanite city. Shevet Dan. The king of Gezer comes to wage war with Israel again to help the neighboring city of Lachish. Vayakeu Yehoshua ve'et amo ad bilti hishir lo sarid. Yehoshua taught him a lesson the last time he will ever come to assist Lachish in the battle against Israel. Yehoshua and his people smote them by the sword ad bilti hishir lo sarid, which means
a remnant was
not a remnant. Not a remnant was left. Sounds like, right? Sounds like they fulfilled the biblical mitzvah of Lo Techaye Kol Neshama.
But not a remnant of the army.
That's not clear at all. Ad Bilti Yishir Lo Sarid is a harsh term. It's a harsh term.
You, is it just those that fought? What about the women and children?
Again, the Torah's command is, "L'tachayah kol neshama." The Torah's command is nobody. Take a look for a moment at chapter 16, verse 10. V'lo horishu et ha-kna'ani ha-yoshev be-gezer. Israel was never able to dispossess the local Canaanite population of the city of Gezer, and the Canaanites in Gezer remained amidst the people of Ephraim until this day. Did I miss something? They wiped out Gezer ad bilti hishir lo sarid, till not one was left. But there's an entire Canaanite city of Gezer that we were not able to touch. So what did we do? And why use a language that says ad bilti ish'il sarid if it doesn't mean that? And that's not just an example. One example, there are many. So what happened in this war? Torah says not a single soul. Navi says, we did it. Lo ad bilti ish'il sarid. Nobody left. Canaanite city of Gezer, we couldn't get to it. Couldn't inhabit it, couldn't dispossess them, couldn't remove the population, couldn't touch them. So what did ad bilti ish'il sarid mean? Let's go one step further. Let's ask the question philosophically. Let's assume for the moment that the command is as follows. You have an option of peace. If you take it, great. And if you don't, there's war. Right? And that war, if I take it on the face value, which means ethnic cleansing and everybody's wiped out, man, woman, and child. So what happens? Let's walk through the battlefield, the battle scene. You start with the battle between soldiers. Soldiers of Israel, soldiers of Canaan. So the soldiers of Israel walk into the city. Let's take whatever it is, Gezer. And they wipe out the army. Now they're under command to wipe out the women and children. So it would seem, right? Now, is there anybody left to defend the city? Assuming that we took out the army first, there's nobody left to defend the city. So the city is completely defenseless, and the Torah's command is, "L'tachaya kol neshama." We walk into the city, what do you think is going to happen? What's the first thing that's going to happen? Say that it louder.
Surrender.
They will surrender. Okay, so now they've surrendered. Now what?
There's nobody left.
There's women, there's children, there's the old people, the young people, the army's gone. Right? Always, stage one, take out the army. Stage two, non-combatants. Now what happens to the non-combatants? The army walks in. Torah says, nobody's left alive. Army walks in, and they say, we surrender. What happens now? So before I told you that there was an option of peace, you would say, there's no option with the nations of Canaan. Everybody has to be wiped out, ethnic cleansing, and the country has to be void of Canaanites. But once I told you, once I've shown you, that there's an option to surrender and accept terms of surrender, to accept terms of citizenship in the state of Israel, so where are you ever going to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of attacking non-combatants? Every time you walk into a city, the first thing they're going to do is surrender. The moment they surrender, we're back to square one, which is the option of peace. The moment I put the option of peace on the table with the Amei Canaan, I will never get to the Torah's command of destroying non-combatants. Because they will always surrender when the army is destroyed.
Why was peace never an option?
Before we started this class, we understood the Torah's command as the option of peace is for nations outside of the nation of Canaan. For the nation of Canaan, there is no option of peace. It's a complete war to obliterate Lo Techaya Kol Neshama. That's the pshat of the pasuk. That's how Rashi understood it. And that's how we understood it before we walked into today's class. Amalek. There was an option of peace with Amalek? No. Now, I showed you the Gemara, showed you the Rambam. There's an option of peace with Amalek. The same thing applies to Amalek, by the way. So how does the battle with Amalek work? You walk into Amalek, you take out the army first. What's left are women and children. They surrender. And then what? And then there's peace. So where did this myth come from that we have to obliterate every man, woman, and child?
It sounds like the ideal.
Maybe you could even articulate that it's an ideal, or you could even say that it's an unrealistic ideal that never got implemented. I'm not sure I would even go that far. But certainly, the moment I give you an option of peace, I take off the table the notion of any kind of ethnic cleansing, total obliteration of non-combatants. If there's always an option of peace, there's always an option of peace. The moment the army is decimated, the local population will do one of two things. They will either accept your terms and surrender, or they will leave. One of the two. But they will never, the women and children will never continue the battle until the end. That's ridiculous. So now I'm completely confused.
The problem is that they might, in some form or another, either I doubt.
So then they have the option. They can, either if they want to continue the idolatry, they can do it somewhere else. There's nobody to defend them anymore. So you've essentially imposed law. The local law of the land is no child sacrifice. They don't like it, they can leave.
But this is interesting that the pasuk said that they never inhabit Geder. I mean, that the nation never captures it in a way, because, I mean, they don't integrate. I mean, they keep it as a separate city.
Well, that will get to in Sefer Yehoshua. One of the issues in Yehoshua is that they never finish the job. Right? Even what the Torah expects them to do, which is to remove the idolatry, they never do. Mm-hmm. So that's a separate theme of Sefer Yehoshua, but my point was only the contrast between the description of how they conquered the army of Gezer and the fact that they never get to the city. Yeah?
How does Rashi though understand
the Torah? I have no explanation for Rashi. Mm-hmm. I have no explanation for Rashi. It doesn't... I don't understand it. It doesn't work. First of all, I'm not sure it even works in the Pshat. We'll get to the Pshat of the Pasuk in a moment. But it certainly doesn't work in the Halacha, and it certainly doesn't work in Sefer Yehoshua. The truth is, methodologically, Shana's something about Rashi's Perish and Chumash. Rashi's Perish and Chumash was focused on what Rashi understood as the Pshat and the Pasuk. There is more than a few instances where Rashi's interpretation of a Pasuk actually negates or is against the Halachic interpretation of a Pasuk. And Rashi's not bothered by it. Rashi essentially argues that you can have a distinction between a pshat and a halachic understanding of a text. In this particular instance, I think, however, and that's where the Ramban's issue, the Ramban says on this Rashi that it's not pshat. That the text he's reading the text incorrectly, that's machloket Rashi and Ramban. So what do I do with this? I'm going to take you back to that text. I want to show you how the Ramban reads it. And with a little bit of an additional twist, I think we can put forward a suggestion that will resolve this tension and will resolve the contradiction. So let's go back to Dvarim. Dvarim chapter 20. Let's read it Rashi's way first, and then I'll show you how the Ramban reads it. According to Rashi, the way you read it is as follows. Chapter 20, starting with verse 10. Two options of war, Mechemet Rishut and Mechemet Mitzvah. Mechemet Rishut starts as follows. If you engage a city in war, you have to first extend a hand of peace. And if they will answer you in peace, then you will take, and then everything that is there, the people that are there will serve you, they will pay tribute to you, they will pay taxes to you, they will accept your sovereignty. And if they don't accept your peace, then they will wage war with you, you will besiege them, you will take out all of the males, the females, the spoils, the children are all part of the spoils of war. All of that is option one, namely... All of that is option one, namely Mechemet. That option one, Mechemet Rishut. That's all chametz reshut. Where you have an option of peace, where you take the males, where the females are left alive, they can be taken captive, they can have spoils, etc. Option two, and so it says, Ken ta'aseh l'chol le'arim arechokot mimcha ma'od, that's all for faraway nations, foreign nations, nations outside of the land of Canaan. Pasuk tetzayin, rak mi'arei ha'amim ha'ele, but with regards to these nations, that God will give you the land as an inheritance, lo t'chaya kol neshama, nobody's left alive. No option for peace, no option for treaties, lo t'chot lahem brit, nothing. Black and white. Two options. So read Rashi. Ramban argues that that is incorrect. And that the way you have to read this psukim is that there aren't two parts to this parak. There are three. And the way you would read it, or the way I read it, is as follows. And this is, again, this is for the most part how the Ramban understood it. There's one additional embellishment here which I'll show you. I don't think, though, it's too far off the pshat. This parak becomes the operative principle of the Torah's laws of the rules of engagement. Rules of engagement start with a declaration. Ki tikrav el ir li lachem aleha v'krata aleha l'shalom. Rule of engagement number one, as the Rambam wrote, no war can be conducted with any nation under the sun. Im adam ba'olam. Without first extending a hand of peace. So says the Gemara in Yerushalmi, so says the Rambam in Chot Melachim, so says the Ramban, that's the halach. Period. Are we talking about a Mechamet Reshut or a Mechamet Mitzvah? Both. That's the thesis of the Ramban. Both. And along those lines, the Torah goes on. Ve'ayim shalom tancha upatchalach ve'ayah kol ama nintzaba yulachala masva avaducha, says the Rambam. Mechamet Mitzvah or Mechamet Reshut. If they answer you by accepting your terms of peace, they will pay taxes and serve you, meaning they don't have to be your servants or your slaves, they can be citizens of equal rights, but what the taxes means, who's the sovereign power?
You control.
Right? You control. You control the territory, and therefore you control the laws. And the laws, in this case, are, right? Certainly in the land of Canaan, no idolatry, Sheva Mitzot, Nenoach, the immoral practices of pagan Canaan must cease. But if they won't make peace with you, and now we have a war, now there are two options. Option A and Option B. Option A, you besiege the city, and God will give them into your hands. Then you can take out the male combatants, whereas for the females and the children and the spoils of war, that's yours for the taking. That's what you should do to all the nations that live far away from you, who aren't from the nations of Canaan. Option A. Option B, as far as the local indigenous population, nobody that's left alive. Again, that's the code phrase that we have a mystery, we have a difficulty with, because if there's always the option of peace, I'll never get to this. We have to understand what that means. But you will utterly destroy the Lechiti Amori, Knani, Pisa, Kibi, and Lucy, in case you didn't know who we're talking about. There's a reason for this, namely, we don't want the influence, we don't want the cultural influence of the local population. That's how the Ramban reads it. That seems to be how the Gemara read it. That the option of peace is a universal one. The split happens in Pasuk Yudbet between two types of paradigms of war. Paradigm for a Meknan, paradigm for Mechamed Rishut. If that's the case, I would like to take this paradigm division one step further. And suggest to you that when the Torah says Lo Techaya Kol Neshama, I already showed you that practically you'll never get there. I would suggest to you that not only practically you'll never get there, ideally you'll never get there, and the Torah never meant for you to get there. And that's what I want to prove to you in the 10 minutes remaining. Yes?
You can get there if they don't accept peace.
After you've taken out all of the army and all of the combatants, what's left are women and children.
Right.
Who's going to fight this war?
They
at what point are the women and children going to surrender? Never?
No, but I thought according to Rambam, you're saying if there's no peace...
Then you start the war. And then what happens in the middle of the war when you've taken out all the soldiers? There's always an option. Right, and when they surrender and they say, we want peace?
Doesn't still apply?
Of course, the option of peace is always there.
No, I think
fine, until they say we surrender.
But even still, no, that's not enough.
Once they say we surrender,
right,
then we're back to square one. You're saying that once the war starts, we take that offer off the table?
Yeah.
That's what you kill
them. Unconscionable. Unconscionable. It's unimaginable. It doesn't make any sense. If I gave them the option of peace before, and now I take it away from them? It doesn't make any sense. And the reality is we never did it. I showed you by Gezer. The reality also speaks to the fact that they never did it that often. There's no example anywhere in Sefer Kna, in Sefer Yeshua, where they wiped out the women and children. So, what do I do with this? So let me suggest to you the following thesis. I heard this from Rav Meidan. It's written up in the article on Musar Kibush Milchama, which I told you was published in the Gush a number of years ago on the Yom Yun and Sefer Yeshua. I think it's very compelling. It's somewhat of a chiddush, somewhat of a creative idea, but I think it fits the pshat as well. If you take a good look at how I have divided these two paragraphs, what have I done? Just visually, schematically, what have I done here? This is universal, call for peace. This is to tell me what group I'm talking, what type of, who I'm attacking, outside of Land of Nine, inside Land of Nine, okay. And this is your description of the battle plan. Right? And when you describe that battle plan, two things stand out. Number one, when it comes to nations outside of Canaan, there's an emphasis on spoils of war. Biza. There's no reference anywhere to Biza in this passage. Forget the population, women and children. What about the cattle? What happened to the Biza? There's no reference to it here.
Well, you could say, "Lot hakol shamam
yudin." Oh, you said, now you're going to kill the animals too? Right? And Amalek, you would never command to kill the animals. It was never the instruction. We get to Amalek Bezrat Hashem one day. We'll study Sefer Shmuel, and I'll show you there was never an assumption to kill the animals. What does it mean? So here I put two phrases opposite each other. Betzarta alea and lo tachayekom neshama. We've ignored this phrase, but it's a critical phrase. Betzarta alea means you will besiege the city. Where did a siege come into the picture? Where did a siege enter into the picture? Who's talking about sieges? What is a siege? Take a city, surround it, starve the population. What kind of war would you... When would you ever want to wage a war? It takes a long time to besiege a city, right? It can take years to fight a battle with a siege format. Much easier to fight them head on, draw them out into the middle of the open field, and deal with them on the open field, which is how Yeshua conquers all of Canaan. There's no siege anywhere in all of Sefer Yeshua. Every city in Sefer Yeshua is a walled city. There's not a single siege in all of Sefer Yeshua. You would think, how do you deal with a walled city? You besiege the city, you starve the population. Not once Does Yeshua ever take that tactic? Why not? Because it's a tactic that the Torah defines only for Mechamed Rishut. It's a tactic the Torah does not allow for Mechamed Mitzvah. Therein lies the key. Lo techayek on the Shema is not a statement that you have to cleanse, ethnic cleansing and genocide and killing women and children. Lo techayek on the Shema is a code phrase. It means there are two types of battle plans. Battle plan A is designed to besiege the population. It takes a long time to wage a war of siege. Battle plan B, no siege. You enter into combat head on with the local population. Whoever comes to attack, that's who you fight. Lo techayek on the Shema, it's an all-out blitz. In and out. The issue is not one of whether you're allowed to kill non-combatants. I don't believe the Torah ever meant for us to kill non-combatants. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is the purpose, the mandate, the structure, the paradigm of this campaign. Why do I say that? Let's take a look for a moment and ask the question, what is the purpose of a siege type of battle? What's the purpose of a siege? Why would you engage a siege rather than a head-on battle with the enemy? So I'll show you one example, a very powerful example. Take a look in Book of Kings, chapter 20. There you go. 2018, same verse. Just different book. 2018, same verse as 2018. Just different book. Malachim Aleph. 2018. Context. Siege of the Shomron. Siege of the Shomron was a siege of the Jewish community, the kingdom of the Shomron, waged by the kingdom of Aram. It was a lengthy siege. It was a devastating siege. Starved the population in lengthy description for chapters on end. About the starvation of the population. Sorry, did I say? Yeah, Malachim Aleph. Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, takes his entire army, 32 kings with him, Sus Verechev, and Bayatza al Hashomron, beginning of the chapter. I just read the first verse. Jump down to verse 17. Vayetzu narei sarei medinot barishona, vayishlach Ben Hadad v'agidol lemor anatzim yotzu mishomron. Years after the siege begins, a messenger comes out and tells the king of Aram, a man by the name of Ben Hadad, I see some Israelites from the Shomron emerging from the siege. So you have your first trickle of people coming out of the siege. And somebody comes out of the siege, comes out for one of two reasons. Either to surrender or to fight. One of the options, right? What are the instructions from Ben Hadad? Vayomer, im l'shalom yatzau, if they come in peace, meaning to surrender, tifsum chayim, then take them alive. Ve'im l'milchama yatzau, but if they come for war to fight, then chayim tifsum, then alive captured. You hear the two options? What are the instructions? If they want to surrender,
capture
them. And if they don't want to surrender, capture them. Someone explain the logic of that? Excuse me?
Drunk?
No, he's not drunk. He's very smart. What's the logic? Logic is very simple. It's the answer to my question earlier. When would you wage a siege war rather than a blitz direct combat? You would wage a siege war when your goal is not to kill the population, it is to subjugate the population. When you want to enslave the population, the more you keep alive, the better. If your goal is to extend sovereignty, let the population continue to live and be well, but you want the political sovereignty and the political power and the slaves and the servants and the spoils of war, it is against your best interests to enter into a direct frontal combat. Because you're going to kill all the males. And you've got to take the women, you've got to take the children, you've got to adopt the families, you've got to provide for the families. That's a problem. You're much better off besieging the population, starving them, demoralizing them, weakening them. Then the few will fight, they'll fight, and the rest of them you get to capture alive and you get to exert your sovereign power over them. All of that is called Vitzarta Alea, a siege war. It's a methodology, it's a mode of conduct, it's a mode of combat, common and utilized in the ancient world, contemporary to Yoshua. It's the mode of combat the Torah prohibits in Canaan. Sartala, siege, when you kill the males and the women and the children and the cattle and the bees and the spoils, yours to retake responsibility for. What do you do with the women and children? If you've killed the husbands and all the men, what do you do with the women and children? You take them into your home. They become your servants, they become your slaves, they become your workers, they become your foreign workers, whatever you want to do with them. But you are responsible for them. Right? That's great if you want to besiege the population and exert power and sovereignty over them. It's not so good if your goal is to remove the idolatrous culture. Because there's nothing here about surrender. They're just all their idolatry and all their culture and everything else. You've just brought into your backyard. Into your home. The Torah's war against Canaan is a war against the culture of Canaan. It's a war against the pagan idolatry of Canaan. The last thing the Torah wanted was for the Israelites to walk into the nations of Canaan, besiege the cities, capture the women and children, and start taking the Canaanite women and bringing them into their backyards and making every Canaanite woman a servant, a slave in the house of an Israelite. The last thing the Torah could possibly have wanted. So the Torah set up a different paradigm for combat in Canaan. It's called Lo Techayekol Neshama. It's a contrast to Vitzartala. It doesn't mean, I don't think, a literal obliteration of every man, woman, and child. It's a paradigm shift of how to combat, of how to wage this war. It's not a 3-year siege per city. It's a blitz. Whoever comes at you, that's who you take out. The rest of the population can either leave or accept the terms of Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach. But there's no spoils. There's no shlav. There's no option for spoils. There's no options for spoils because the Torah doesn't want the Canaanite culture in your backyard. The first campaign Yoshua ever fights is Yericho. And what's the first thing Yoshua does when he finishes Yericho? He announces a total, complete ban on any of the spoils of Yericho. Which leads to the failure and the battle of Ai. But that's exactly what he did. He understood there can be no spoils in this campaign. This campaign is a blitz. It's a campaign of ideological terms. We don't have the right to take for our own personal gain and power. We're not looking to subjugate the Canaanite population. We're not looking to turn their wealth into our wealth. That we are looking for them, they can live and be well and live on their own and stay where they are. All they have to do is agree to a moral code. The idolatry-free zone in the land of Israel. They want to accept those terms? The Karata Le'el Shalom. No? Then we will wage war. Not siege you. Not capture you. Not subjugate you. But a war. And the moment the war is over, one of two things happen. You will either leave or surrender. And then we're back to here. That's the cycle of Sefer Yoshua. So even though it's on the face of it, it sounds like there's this mandate, Lo techayekol neshama, you can't let anybody live, man, woman, child, beast. I don't think that's what the Torah meant. I don't think it meant it for Amek Canaan. I don't think it meant it for Amalek. Story of Amalek, Bezvat Hashem, one day we'll get to Sefer Shmuel. And the common misinterpretations of Sefer of that particular story. But This is how I understand the context of Otachayakon Neshama. It's the operative principle, I think, under which Yeshua was working. Never do they conduct any kind of genocidal annihilation of a city. There's one or two cities that talk about razing the city to the ground. Doesn't say anything about the population. One or two possible exceptions. But overall, this is what the operative principle, I think, was in Sefer Yeshua. It changes the tenor of the nature of the book. And from here, we're ready to move forward to the rest of Paragraph. Zat Hashem, next week, we move on.
Thank you.